Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today is Guillaume Bayette.
Hello.
Hello, Guillaume. Also with me today, Mr. John Lindemann.
Hey, James.
Hey, John. Okay, I was worried there was a follow-on to that, but I guess we're in the clear.
Nope.
Thank you. And last but not least, Mr. Greg Lay.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Greg.
Good to be with you again, James.
It's always good to be with you, Greg. It's April 21st, 2016, and this is episode 473, which means we're two away from an episode that I guess means as much as 450, but we're not going to do nearly as much about it. So, it's that time again.
That time?
Games are out. Games, plural. Plural games are out to talk about here. And for that reason, it's time for new business. And I'm going to lead off this week because I actually passed last week because I'm the host and I understand sacrifices had to be made. And I am going to talk about Bravely Second, which we got a long time after, Greg, you did. I know you've talked about it on the show before and had a quite, you know, fairly exhaustive description of the game insofar as, hey, it's Bravely Default again to a large degree. So if you've already played it, you know, it's kind of like when we talked about the second 3DS Fire Emblem game. There's a certain amount of it is the same. So I actually want to talk a bit about how this game packages its demo a little bit, and then we'll kind of get into the game. So first off, we got an email about 2 weeks ago on the show where somebody asked us about the death of the Game Boy Advance, or was the regular game? Oh, the DS. Excuse me.
Yes.
The death of the DS. Where they said, why can't we just get more games that just reuse assets and basically make sequels for games that we love kind of on the cheap? And that's a lot of what this game is. Even playing the demo, some of the areas are new. Like,
yeah, the email specifically referenced this game as kind of, though it was on the next generation of systems from the target that he was talking about, as the sort of thing he was envisioning.
Right, but I was kind of taken aback by how much it feels.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like an add-on. It's kind of like a weird remix. It's very strange. Like, there's an incredible, like, I don't want to say it's nostalgia, but it's also not quite the deja vu to, I guess that's probably the best way to describe it. There's like a weird deja vu to playing this game, especially when you go to places that are in the first game. So very early in the game, you end up at Eternia, which is a very late area in the original game.
Yeah.
And it's like, we need to go to the hospital. I'm like, oh, I know where that is. Why do I know where that is? Oh, because this is the same place. This is weird.
Yeah.
This is very strange.
There's plenty of that in the full game as well.
Yeah. So the demo, I thought, actually is really smart because we talked about the demo for the first game when it came out, and that was kind of what turned the hype engine to 11 for us for that game, because that was a very good demo. It kind of told this self-contained story about, you know, the party was already good. It was almost like a side story, except for the fact that all the characters in the demo, including the bad guys, show up in the main story, but with a different plot almost. It was just kind of like, we're just going to remix the game to show you what the mechanics are. Remix these characters into kind of like a short version. What I was impressed by in this demo is that it actually went and told us like a fully self-contained story in the arc of a demo, starring characters from the main game and giving you background to them. And that actually feeds into the main game where they talk about it. Like there's a brief interlude where they actually talk about the events of the demo. I thought that was a really nice touch, but I kind of dig the demo because it's long. It's a long. I cleared it in about 5.5 hours.
Which I may or may not have, for me.
Which I may or may not have played all through Sunday, just straight. Because I ordered the game on Thursday, and because it wasn't in the nearby Amazon facility, I didn't get it till Tuesday. So I just marathoned the demo, and by the end of the demo, I was in deep. I was like, I need this game to come out right now. I think I just like the pacing of the demo. It's very quick to level up. It's very quick to let you experiment with classes. And it's kind of a weird open worldy thing. Like, you just have quests you can pick up and do, which is not very similar to the main game at all. But I kind of like it. And I kind of like the idea of maybe in the late... I mean, I would have paid money for that. I probably would have paid $10 for that demo. Which, don't tell Square Enix that. Like, but like that was a full game experience. There was a final boss. There was a story. Characters grew and developed. You met characters. They developed interactions with one another. You got to play with classes, play with the weird configuration of the battle system. You got to try mixing classes, which is a big feature of this game, and skills and weapons. And like, it was a full experience that was really neat. 5 hours into the main game, which is about how far I'm in now, you get to the title card. Which I want to go ahead and say has got to be the latest title card in any 3DS game ever.
Wow.
Really, really impressive. Like, it came up and I'm like, wait, is this the opening? There's J-pop. This is the opening sequence.
All I'll say about that, James, is it won't be the last time you see that.
Oh, good. Is it between chapters? Great. Like, I was like, oh my god, this is J-pop. This is the opening sequence. I'm actually kind of, something the best way to put this. I like that in the beginning of the first game, the beginning of the second game, like not the demo anymore. I like that they introduced the main character in the demo, gave him backstory, and then basically just sort of disposed of it in the main game. Like, you don't have to do it. There's a demo. You can go, if you want to go find out more about him, go play the demo. And I think actually the game tells you, if you want to know more about his backstory, go download the demo. But I like that they very quickly just give you the party. Which I think is a concession for the fact that this game is the sequel. And if you haven't played Bravely Default, you're probably hopelessly lost. Because we're not going to introduce any of these characters. Most of them are retreads. So, Idia and Tiz are like main party characters again. So we're not going to tell you about their history. You know who they are. If you want to read more about it, go to the internet. Like, I kind of dig that they just acknowledge they had to do that. It's weird to see concessions like this because JRPGs very rarely have direct sequels.
Yeah, I mean, Golden Sun is the only other one I can think of that's like that. Where that
Golden
think they really...
Sun does that, but yeah. They kick it. They basically give you a whole second party for the first 2/3 of the game.
Yeah,
because you've got essentially the antagonist's party for most of the game, the antagonist and the kidnapper and the kidnapped victims. Mm-hmm. And they have to do that, and there's a very good reason. Because the main party from the first game just went and beat, like, this all-powerful, all-world-consuming demon. They should be unstoppable. And then putting them having to fight rabbits doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Yeah.
I know it's been, like, 2 years, but muscles don't atrophy that quick. Like, Edia should just be wiping out the bosses for the first 2/3 of the game. Just, like, one hit, killing all of them. And they have to kind of Samus her and take away all of her classes, all of her skills, all of her HP growth and all of her stat growth and just reset her. So most JRPGs, because developing the party is so, you know, integral to what they are, just say, even if it's a sequel, it's like, I don't know, next generation. And in fact, Golden Sun 3 does that. It's just, oh, this is the main party's kids. You're like, oh, all right, whatever, that's fine. That's why they're all useless and dumb and pointless and don't have any skills or good weapons and... You have to learn everything over again. The Breath of Fire games do that endlessly. It's like, oh, this is the grandkids. This is the great-grandkids. This is the children. So seeing them kind of have to work through that by just giving you these characters you already know and not forcing you to, like, really get into their backstory. Like, they're giving you the cliff notes of their back. Like, even thinner backstory descriptions than, like, the Wikipedia article for Bravely Default gave the characters. Like... really paper thin background on who Tiz is. Like, things I had to go look up because they referenced them and I can't remember because this game came out like 2 years ago and I forgot. So, it's kind of an interesting experience just to see them have to walk that line. Like, yeah, we know Agnes, but what, you know, they're talking about her quest. We're not really going to tell you what the quest was. You probably played it if you're playing this game. We don't need to remind you. Like, I kind of like seeing, you know, how they, as game designers, dealt with the problem of if we spend 10 hours introducing the party again, people are going to be bored as hell. So let's actually do something with it and just give you the party in the chapter called Prologue. So here's the party. Have fun. All those other characters that you knew of from the first game, here's what happened to them. So you don't have to worry about where they are now. Like, we've shown you their narrative arc, so you can resume just playing the game again. They still have to deal with the fact that half of your party should be overpowering world killers, but they just
it's kind of an explanation for Tiz.
But Edia, there is no explanation whatsoever, like at all, because she's been fighting pretty much since the end. It's like, why is she weak now? Why is she level 5? But Golden Sun, John, to your point, Golden Sun actually handles that because you import the other party. So, like, when you finally get to the point where you have access to Isaac and co, like, they're actually appropriate levels from their fight with Sartorius and Minardi. Like, they're actually at the right place for you to be, and I think maybe it caps them. But, like, that's how you end up with all of the Jin, like, you just because you've imported the entire party. So, separating you apart gives you that opportunity to build this game's party back up, and then when you reunion them, it's fine. So it is kind of a weird thing, but I'm enjoying just sort of getting back in there. And I forgot how good this game's battle system really is. And I like the little tweaks they've made to it. I really dig the idea of just like, if you clear it out in one turn, if you clear a battle in one turn, you can continue. Nobody regains any brave points. And you can just keep doing that until you're unable to clear the battle in one turn, and it increases the multiplier on your experience, your money, your job points. And of course, you get more because you kill more enemies.
Yeah.
And like, I've found myself cranking that thing all the way up to 3x, which is as far as it'll go. And just like sitting there going, come on, give me your party's feeling brave to give me movement points back. And just like really having a good time trying to figure out how to game that thing to just max it out. And yeah, that's part of why it took me over 5 hours to clear the prologue, because I spent time grinding to get good at that. But at the same time, getting like 130 job points in one battle is pretty cool. Getting 1,000.
Later on in the game, you can actually, with regular battles, kind of like hit, because you know that you can ever get more than 999 job points from a single kind of round of encounters. So late game, you can actually hit that. You know, you would have got more, but you know, like that's
just,
the kind of.
You said nope, no good.
No, you can never get more than that in one round of rewards being given to you for a battle.
I do like that it's also giving you asterisks pretty quickly. Like, I've got 4 or 5 by the end of the prologue.
Well, there's a lot of them, because when you factor in that you've got a whole bunch of new ones and all the old ones are going to show up at some point, then you have got a hell of a lot of jobs to grapple with. So, yeah, I like that. I like it, because it definitely gives you something to... Obviously, you don't have to, but my inclination was very much to just experiment pretty fast, and it just changes up the gameplay a lot of the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've already mastered Freelancer for the main character of this game and the other new character, because they didn't give us much, and that whole, like, when I was able to consistently get the 3x multiplier and stack more battles on top of the 3x multiplier... Like, you get a lot of job points, and it just rips through level after level after level after level.
And is it one of the things that the freelancer learns, like, 1.2 times the job points as well? So
something like that, yeah.
You can equip that, and then you'll gain it even faster.
Yeah, so having mastered a class already feels really good. Like, it feels really, really good. And like part of what made the demo feel so good was they amped up all the experience. So like you could finish up a class in like 20 minutes if you were getting really good at hitting that multiplier.
Didn't they kind of cap it at job level 4 or something in the demo? I think it was. Yeah. Whereas of course it goes way beyond that if you do it in the regular game.
I'm just having a good time with it. Like it's neat to get back in there and see the game systems again, see the art of this game because it's still really good. Actually, kind of like the music less for some reason. Like
it's a different composer. It's there's a fair bit of reuse to go back to that whole thing again. You know, right. There will be pieces of music in it that were in the first one, but the new stuff, it's not bad, but I don't feel it's as good. So
I was kind of surprised to hear that the special move themes weren't reused, because like that's some of the best music in the first game.
They do get reused, but not for special moves anymore. Like it's just kind of like a one-off. It'll appear like once in a cutscene or something. But like the new special move themes might be some of the weakest. They're all a bit samey, you know. I mean, obviously, in the original game, you had the signature instruments that really kind of sold it, and you know, didn't necessarily demand them do the same thing again or anything, but they're just kind of not memorable at all and not particularly distinguishable. All very guitar driven in this case, from what I remember of it. Although I did a hell of a lot of play with sound off, as you might imagine.
I popped Idia's move like in a boss battle and thought, oh, here comes Baby Bird, and then fuck you, what is this awful song that you're playing right now? What is this garbage? What is this? And to be fair, Baby Bird's a terrible song. Like
it's beautiful.
But it's delightfully bad.
It's
like
there's something about it. Everyone says it's the end of a sort of late 80s, 90s TV show.
It's so inappropriate that it's just it doesn't really even fit her character either. Like it fits like this weird facet of her. It's like, oh, this song is dumb. I love it. It's awful. But like then I pop Tizzes and I'm like, well, certainly they're gonna get You're My Hope here. Nope, it's some other piece of shit. What is this?
You remember those. Like I said, you remember them. You remember the
instruments. I remember their names.
They are memorable, whereas there's a lot of the new stuff in this was not particularly memorable for me.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed, and I actually went about this on Twitter, is that there's something weird about the voice recording in this game. Like, all of the sibilance pops, and everything sounds squished. And I don't know if that's, like, some awful ear training that's come from doing this show forever, but, like, it's super bothering me. Like,
I don't know, it's interesting. I did quite a bit of playing with the sound off, so I didn't have a strong opinion on the voices. I assumed it was just, like, compression or something, but, yeah, I didn't think they sounded very clear.
No, it sounds like they've like compressed it down to like a really low bitrate. And I don't know why. The game cartridge is pretty big. Like, what? And the demo does it. The full game does it. And I haven't gone back to check Bravely Default yet to see if that does it too, but I bet it does. It's very weird.
It's dual audio though, right? Has it got the Japanese voices or something? Could that be it?
Maybe. I wondered if it was stylistic. Like this was deliberate. Because there's a very weird, like, this sounds like it was recorded in a recording booth quality to the audio. Like, it sounds almost too pure, but also low bitrate. So it doesn't sound like people having a conversation. It sounds like people talking to a microphone in a soundproof booth. It's weird.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's always that. There's a lot of that sort of problem where they can never seem to talk over each other naturally. So, where it's written as if they were talking over each other, but then you just have these very clean separations between their lines, it just, that always comes across as unnatural. But I guess that's a big problem with a lot of these sorts of projects, because they're just not going to get people in the same room or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, to do it. So it's just kind of a natural issue.
It's weird to spend this much time talking about the voice, not even the voice acting, the voice recording quality of of a JRPG on the 3DS, but it is like super bothering me through the whole demo. And they talk a lot during the demo. Like they tell a fairly exhaustive story in the demo, and I'm like, dude, get a better mic, bro. Like these are like professional voice actors I have heard in things. I know this is recorded in a sound studio. Like, what is happening? I don't know. It's a weird thing to be obsessed about, but it bothered me to no end for the demo. I've sort of pushed it out of my head because they talk a lot less frequently in the full game. Because the demo, they're just jamming all that story into 5 hours. But now, if you're playing this game, you won't not be able to notice it. You're welcome. John. Buddy.
I'm here, man.
What have you been playing?
Nothing really too new, but Axiom Verge came out on Vita, and I've been playing that a little bit.
They've got a release window in that little video they put out just recently, the Damon Baker video thing, or that was promising by the end of the quarter for Axiom Verge on Wii U.
Yep. So yeah, and you know I've talked about it before, and really when I played this previously, it was on PS4, and it never really felt right to me on PS4. It just seemed like it always felt like I was playing on like Super Game Boy or something, right? It just never, like, the game looks really good and all that kind of stuff, but it just never really felt right playing it on a big screen. So playing it on the Vita screen is really, really nice. It really looks good. They have a couple of small sort of Vita enhancements. They have kind of touch areas on the Vita screen, like in the bottom left and bottom right, where you can, you know, kind of map stuff to them, sort of hotkey type functionality. So that's kind of nice. But overall, I mean, it just, I'll play through it now because, I mean, I started it right after I played through Ori and the Blind Forest, and I was just completely, I just did not feel like playing another Metroidvania game. But I'm back in the mood for it now, so I think I'm going to have a run through it. And it's just, it plays really, really nice in the Vita. And I was thinking that on Wii U, it would be perfect, the perfect type of game to play through on the gamepad, because that's really my preferred way of playing Super Nintendo games. Mm-hmm. On Wii U, and this is basically, it's effectively a 16-bit game. It's what it behaves like, looks like, plays like, and I think it'll be really, really good on Wii U playing it on the gamepad. And I mean, if you haven't played it, it's a no-brainer if you like any sort of Metroid game. So yeah, I'd highly recommend it. And I mean, it's cross-play with the PS4, so if you happen to have a Vita and you already have it on PS4 and haven't played through it like me, then you can just play through it on Vita. So, yep. So that's it. So definitely, I mean, if you get this when it comes to Wii U, that's pretty much all I have to say about that.
Yeah, that's probably, I mean, it is coming to Xbox One as well, but mm-hmm. It's like you say, the gamepad part, especially it seems like, you know, the backtracking and all that kind of stuff, it's a better fit. So that's what I'm holding out for.
Yep, yep. Totally agree.
Johnny Metz disclaimer here.
Yeah. Yep. You know, I'm making sure not to shill for it too hard because I'm not getting any kickbacks.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, we're not on the take.
I suppose that, you know, thinking also about news that came out this week. You know, there wasn't anything about Mother 3, the 10th anniversary, sort of just came and went. But we did get the delay for Metroid Prime Federation Force. Quite a fat delay to August.
Yeah,
when previously they said spring. I mean, that was quite a surprise. And just kind of nudged it out there and no particular kind of fanfare. I know there's kind of the speculation that somehow they've delayed it beyond E3 because they might actually show a more conventional Metroid game at E3 and therefore diffuse the antipathy that exists towards the Federation Force. I don't know how much I'd buy that, but yeah. I wouldn't mind if it were true. Let's put it that way.
I know, it sounds kind of conspiracy theory to me, but...
Yeah, totally.
You know, I'm down with it if it happens. But, the way I looked at it was like, hey, you know, you have to, when you have a Game of the Year candidate like that, you got to keep that, you know, put that off until late in the year so it stays fresh in the voters, in the Academy voters'
yeah,
minds.
Yeah, it's true, right? In Oscar season, it's going to be, it's gonna be a lot of Oscar buzz.
Very savvy.
You know, we had put the Federation Force embargo on the show for a reason. You assholes.
It's a game. It exists.
Does it exist? Have you played it?
No. People have played it.
Is this Schrodinger's video game?
Unfortunately, unlike Blatterhouse, there's no ambiguity. it does exist. People will be playing it at PAX East. It's a thing. And so, we cover it. Mm-hmm. That's reality.
Yep. We're forced to. Nintendo's forcing our hand here, James.
No, Nintendo is forcing us to mention the date. They're not forcing us to start talking about its Oscar contention status.
Well, now that Leo's finally, you know,
does anyone get sexually mauled by a bear in it? That's the question,
right?
Yeah,
that's the thing. He's out of the queue now, so it's all up for grabs. So Federation Force could totally get back
in. Best actor for acting like a competent video game, Metroid.
All right, you haven't played it, John. Stop it.
That's
I'm not standing up for
what?
A Metroid game by choice, but somebody has to.
Sorry. It's just such an easy target. It really is an easy target.
At this point, I'm just going to get it and enjoy it out of spite. Not because of any intrinsic qualities, just to shove it up.
I'm
going to
paint that smile on my face.
Yep. Oh, dear me. I've got an open mind about it in terms of the quality of the game. I just think it's interesting that it's been delayed that much. You know, I mean, when that happened with Star Fox, it was a lot bigger news. I guess some of that might be about enthusiasm or whatever, but you just considering this has supposedly been sort of cooking in the background since the DSi, it's, you know, it seems like an interesting thing to happen that, you know, maybe it isn't just about the production of the game. Maybe there are other factors in play there.
Yeah.
I have nothing else.
Good.
Well, nothing further, Your Honor.
John, I want you to be proud of yourself. You made me stand up for a Metroid game. Mm-hmm. You monster. You are a monster, sir.
Mission accomplished.
Where are we going?
Guillaume, what are you playing?
Okay, so I have gotten Star Ghost, this game on the Wii U eShop, and it's worth, you know, like it got my interest just because, well, first, it kind of looked good. The trailer, you know, has this kind of neon, the I don't know, kind of this Geometry Wars kind of look a little bit. But also,
if you see the trailer where there's just a guy carrying a little disc around. And, like,
yeah, that's how it starts. But then it spices
in. It seems like a really weird mix with the actual visuals of the game. I'm not exactly sure what they were going
for. Yeah, I don't know. Like you look at some of the trailers on the Wii U eShop, and basically what I understand is that indies do whatever they want. And Nintendo puts it on their web page.
If they want cats, they get cats.
Yeah, well, it's a... cats are nice. Cats are cute. Whatever. But this game is interesting because it's made by a former retro developer. But then you start playing it and you realize, oh no, this is probably one of the jerks responsible for the rocket barrel levels in Donkey Kong Country Return games. Because
I like those levels.
They're good. I enjoy them. I'm being facetious, but it's a shooter. It's a shoot 'em up and side scrolling. But instead of controlling, you know, up down using the D-pad, you're actually feathering the boost. You know, as just like in one of those rocket barrel stages, you know, kind of like Flappy Bird, except Flappy Bird doesn't, you know, you just keep pressing the button. In this case, it's like you can hold it down and, but yeah, so in the meantime, like while you're controlling the height at which you're scrolling through the level, the ship attacks automatically. The controls, of course, kind of make the game stand out. Obviously, because of this weird control scheme, the game is quite slow. The scrolling is quite slow, and it's far from a bullet hell shooter. The waves of enemies are pretty predictable, and there's not that many that you have to deal with at any time. At least, you know, for as far into the games I've made it. So the power-up system is kind of interesting because you gain these power-ups, so you increase the spread of your shots, you increase the rate of fire, but eventually if you don't pick up additional power-ups to further increase those aspects of the shooting, there's a timer, like you can see at the bottom screen, at the bottom of the screen, you see the icons and the... there's kind of a cooldown thing going on, and when it gets, you know, when it runs out, then you get downgraded. So you have to keep upgrading the ship at all times. And because you have so little control over your ship, you can only go up or down, you can't move forward, backward, you have, you know, it's more difficult to pick up power-ups than you would think. But there's an additional power up that's a kind of an attraction field. So you can power that up as well. And, so you can just attract the power ups to you. There's kind of a slingshot effect going on. If you remember Apollo 13, There's like, you know, the power up enters the field and then goes in your general direction. But if you move, or if, you know, for whatever reason, if it doesn't go directly to you, it misses, and then it kind of slows down and turns back and comes back to you. And so you have the, it's kind of weird. Like, you have to play with that a little bit. And, so that makes it so that, well, as I said, like, the ship fires automatically. When you have this attraction field on, you're not shooting anymore. It has this nice little risk-reward kind of thing going on. So, yeah, so I'm enjoying it. I've made it... I'm not sure. Like, I think that the Nintendo page says that there's 12 worlds. I think I've made it to the fourth world, and I've, you know, game-overed. So it's not that easy, and I'm not sure how much variation there's going to be, because so far, it's pretty much, I've seen pretty much the same enemies come back. There's kind of this predictable structure to it, where you're going to have a stage with a few waves of enemies, and then you make it to the end. The next stage is going to be an asteroid field, and with the asteroids kind of looking and behaving like the asteroids in the, you know, the old classic game Asteroids. So so it's kind of cool. But then again, like, waves of enemies, asteroids, and then some sort of like mini boss battle where you have to avoid this ship that's very similar to yours, but a little bit bigger, a little bit more powerful. Yeah, so it's kind of repetitive so far. So
I heard there's procedural elements to the level, isn't there? So it might not be the same if you quite the same if you go through, but I assume it's always got that same kind of formula that you're talking about.
Yeah, there's not really. I haven't been super surprised. Like, there's usually pretty little going on in the levels. That if, like, whatever variation there is on what little is happening is not going to be, like, dramatic. I'm not sure exactly what varies, like, the waves of enemies, I guess, but what varies is not the pattern of this wave of enemy. It's just, like, when it happens, and that's it. It's always, like, right. Once you see it happening, when you see the wave start, you know exactly what you're supposed to do. One other aspect that I found interesting is that the credits, at the end of the level, so you can buy a power up. At first I was buying every power up that I could, because why not? But then I realized that, like, if you don't have enough credits for a certain power up, it won't even show them to you. So once I realized that, I was like, oh, okay, I'm supposed to save these credits.
Well, and just to at least to find out what you can get,
yeah,
before, like, deciding whether to buy it.
Yeah, plus, as I said, like, there's kind of these three basic power-ups, like the rate of fire, spread, and the your attraction field. And those you can find pretty regularly inside the levels themselves, and eventually they max out. So I guess the logic, you know, like, you could upgrade them at the end of the level to be fully boosted, but also... You could also just wait and see, like, well, there's a good chance I'm going to find it in the levels themselves, so I might as well save these credits. But then sometimes you might regret that decision because you realize, oh, crap, like, my spread is not wide enough to deal with these asteroids, and I really should have, you know,
it would have helped quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah. So that's neat. And then 50 credits. If you've got 50 credits and you die, you can continue. So also that's good to know. Yeah, so I am enjoying it. The one big aspect that I'm kind of underwhelmed by is that if this game had a box, one of the back of the box kind of bullet points is that the music is by David Wise.
So he's been getting around lately.
He has, but this one, I don't think, you know, I think he was doing someone a favor because, and he didn't really put that, someone he didn't really like very much. So, I don't know, like the music, I was listening to it and it sounds like something that anyone with a keyboard and musical know-how would have heard, like, okay, a space shooting game, got it, and then went and composed something and was done. Like, there's nothing, it's very, very generic. Maybe if I listen more closely, I recognize, like, the David Wiseness of this piece, but I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, maybe it's just pro bono. I think that's probably a pretty good shout.
Yeah. And very quickly, another game that I've played, well, game. I played the demo of Pocket Card Jockey, a game I'm very excited for. And after playing the demo, I'm still excited for it, but there's a lot going on. Like, there's the demo is basically an extended tutorial, and there's quite a few races actually in it. So, like, you get a good taste of what the full game is going to be. But I'm still kind of, you know, I'm still learning what's happening, because there's a lot of kind of values, such as stamina, that then turns into enthusiasm, which turns into experience points, which turns into, like, they're really, like, there's so many resources, but really there's only one. So I just need to, you know, get used to the game and figure out, oh, okay, like, it doesn't matter what it's called. Like, this enthusiasm thing is just, like, this thing under another name. But to come back to the beginning, so Pocket Card Jockey, you're a jockey, you want to win the big derby, but you don't know what you're doing. And actually, in the beginnings, at the beginning of the game, the story is, like, you hop on your horse, you can't really do anything, and then it kicks you off, and you get trampled, and you're dead. But some sort of angel decides to help you, to revive you, and you promise the angel that you're going to accomplish your dream. And unfortunately, you're a crappy jockey, so the angel asks you, well, is there something you're good at? And your character says, I'm good at playing solitaire. And so it is decided that you're going to win derbies by playing solitaire. So that's the... If you wanted to know, like, what the in-universe explanation was for why you're playing solitaire, like, that's... You do get it. Like, it's not unexplained, so...
This all checks out, by the way.
Yeah.
I played the first bit of the demo. He's not making this up.
Yom didn't just pass out.
This is a glitter Metroid 2. Like, this is legit.
So yeah, you play a kind of a weird, well, weird. It's not weird. It's very simple. It's a kind of solitaire game where you've got, maybe five or six columns of cards. And basically, you grab one, and then you have to grab the one that's immediately the value that's immediately below or over the card that you picked, and you have to keep this going until you run out of you run out of moves, and then you pick in your deck, and you try to get started again. And if you can clear the field of cards, then you get various enthusiasm boosts or whatever, and your character, your little horsey, is just more enthusiastic, and so goes faster and gets more boosts and stuff like that. Anyway, like, there's, you know, you play solitaire, but you do it on a timer, and also you're kind of trying
on a horse.
Strategize there's some strategy to the game, to the racing. It's an interesting demo, and I recommend trying it for yourself. I'm still interested in the main game, but I gotta say, like, Game Freak, I don't know about the old Pokemon games, but Game Freak, between this and Harmonite, I find that they make really, really wordy tutorials. And sure, like, your tutorial guy is a horse with a playing card on its forehead, and it's very cute, very well written, speaks several languages, Italian and French, if you can believe it. So yeah, it's well written, but there's so much of it. So it's a lot to take in at first. Like, you're trying to learn the game, and you're constantly interrupted to, oh yeah, one more thing, this does that. Oh yeah, and this, and also, you know, here's a joke. Oh, and more info. For a solitaire game, like, there's a lot to pick up. But anyway, I'm still playing. It's still fun, and it's very cute, very charming. I said it.
Game comes out next. Yes, you did. Game comes out next month in Europe and North America. Correct?
Yeah, yeah. Month. You can play this demo.
The weird thing is that they hadn't talked about this before in Europe, but then the demo was on the downloads list, and it's like, oh, I guess we're getting it. And turns out we're getting it at the same time as America. Yeah, it just didn't feature in the director or anything.
Yeah.
No, Europe gets the download announcements on Monday. North America gets them basically. Well, we actually know about them ahead of time, but we get them officially the day of. And so, like, I was like, well, Europe's gonna get it, well, fuck those guys. And then, like, oh, it's today, okay, never mind. yeah
put away your pitchforks.
I really am not sure why they're sitting on this. Like, what is there to be that is left to be done? I don't know. Like, the animation looks great, the graphics look great. There's no 3D, so that's disappointing. but
probably just some cert stuff or some region specific nonsense you have to handle.
Right, maybe some localization to be done still. I don't know, but
or just like getting ratings and things squared away. I mean, the game came out in Japan a little while ago, right?
I don't even know.
They probably had just had a plan, and the demo, they gave themselves some extra padding in case they ran into something. And it's like,
oh, right. Maybe they thought, well, we made our demo so wordy and so long and so meaty that we need to give people a full month to really appreciate it.
All right. Greg.
Yes.
You've got the other thing that came out this week.
I do. I got there, luckily, due to a bit of Swiss shipping. I've got Star Fox Zero to talk about. I only got to play it for about probably 90 minutes or so, so I didn't even get to run through it once.
That's good news. You know, I mean, this were the N64 game, you would have.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean,
Star Fox Zero, 90 minutes plus one.
We definitely, there's some reasons for why I haven't finished a run through after 90 minutes, as I'll get into. But I've seen enough to play, obviously, with the regular R-Wing in all range mode, with the Walker. I've played with the Landmaster and that transformation. I've played with the Gyro Wing thing. So I've seen, the vehicles and the controls and all that, and quite a few different level types at this point. So I could give some quick impressions and then... I'll obviously give in-depth thoughts at a later date. But, obviously been a lot of chat about the controls for this one and all that. And, I understand the skepticism, certainly, and it's perfectly reasonable. But one thing that the whole sort of debate reminded me of, or some of the literal quotes from reviews about it being a bit like rubbing your belly and patting your head, it just kind of reminded me of the import impressions of Sin and Punishment back in the old days, and obviously I took the plunge on that. Even though there was quite a lot of, it's not very long, and, these controls are a bit weird and all that, and it turned into one of my favourite games ever. So I've had quite an optimistic sort of outlook with Star Fox Zero on that basis. And from my early impressions playing the game, I mean, I've had a lot of fun with the controls. I don't feel like I've become terribly proficient with them in an hour and a half or so, but I've still had fun kind of getting used to them and get the idea of them down. I mean, the biggest takeaway I've got from it so far is that I feel like the controls and, the way the game's designed around them has made all range mode a hell of a lot more interesting than it was in Star Fox 64. Hmm. I never particularly liked that aspect about Star Fox 64. I thought it was more interesting in theory than it was in practice. It was kind of like, oh, well, now you can fly who you want, you can have dogfights and all that. It sounds exciting, but those levels, I didn't really find them very exciting in practice. I think a good example would be set to Zed in Star Fox 64 on the sort of the hardest route, where you have to take out the missiles before they destroy the Great Fox, is up there with my least favourite levels in the game.
Well, it's garbage.
Yeah, it's not good at all. I mean, there's the submarine level is really slow, so there is that. But at least I like the music and the boss in that. Whereas, set to Zed, I didn't like at all. Then in Play Star Fox Zero, I came across a level, which is fundamentally the same concept. And I was kind of like, ooh. there's a lot of that, as I'm sure people have read, the bits where it sort of reprises, a theme or something, sort of kind of set piece or some kind of thing like that you saw in Star Fox 64 is heavily based on it. We talked about this with Twilight Princess, a thing that happens a lot these days. Just, the sort of quasi remake, the rerun, whatever you want to say, of a sort of a beloved chapter in something from years gone by.
But you see Star Fox in the canon, like it's always a different Star Fox. And it's like this kind of legend that's being retold over and over again.
I like to think that it's sort of like James Bond, and this is the George Lazenby Star Fox at this point. No, I mean,
sorry, are you going to tell us we're going to get the Casino Royale unofficial Star Fox at some point, or find out what the old Star Fox has been up to?
You get the Woody Allen Star Fox, mm-hmm. and then eventually actually gets made where it's like really gritty Daniel Craig Star Fox. That's correct.
Oh, okay.
And Hannibal Lecter playing cards really badly by scratching his eye all the time. Now, so to get back to Star Fox Zero, nice. I got to this point.
We weren't on Star Fox Zero.
No, self-indulgent, Greg.
Very self-indulgent.
Star Fox. So you get this part where the missiles are coming at the Great Fox, and like, oh, here we go. Like, this is not something I particularly wanted to see reprised. But, like, you know, the way it's executed with these new controls, you know, I'm not going to say it's going to probably be my favorite level in this game, but I felt like, yeah, this concept kind of works now, because it just flows a lot better when you've got these two views in terms of, you're taking out, rather than just kind of, you're making passes and just generally shooting at the missile. You're targeting specific parts that are rotating in segments along the missile, taking out. And that's something that's doable with the, you know, the sharpshooting on the gamepad using the gyro sensor. And, you know, what you've also got is the target view, as they call it, on the TV screen, where it's rather just your standard behind the engine kind of view. It tries to take a kind of, first of all, what can be a more kind of cinematic view, you know, just a cooler kind of look at what's going on in the whole environment. But it's also trying to show more just you relative to the thing you're locked onto more. And so now, I guess this is where it could be, it kind of is confusing in terms of you're no longer kind of, forward is forward kind of thing, but that's where you're kind of interpolating, you know, the information between the two screens to get what you want. So you kind of, you know, lining something up on the top screen, and then when you've, say for instance, you turn in the ship, you might, you know, hold back on the thruster to turn the ship quickly, get around, get a target in front of you, then you look down to the gamepad and start shooting, you know, the very specific point on that object that you're trying to kill. And it's very satisfying when it comes together. I really like that. And definitely, you know, when you get a ship in your sights like that, I'm almost tempted to do my best James Earl Jones and say, I have you now, but no good ever comes of that. So I haven't. But like I said, for me, all range mode is a hell of a lot more interesting than it's ever been before. And like the last level I was playing, it actually sort of started you off in the R-Wing and then shifted to Landmaster all range mode and stuff. So it just seems a bit more dynamic, more interesting, and also, I think, more skillful. You know, I just, mm-hmm. I never really felt like those dogfights against Star Wolf or the Independence Day rip-off scenario or whatever in Star Fox 64 really involved a great deal of skill, and it just kind of felt like it was there to say, oh, look, you know, you could, you know, as we talked about with the whole reason for cancelling Star Fox 2, you know, which had this kind of all range type of stuff, you know, it's like, oh, this is something we can do now that we couldn't do before, and in game design it didn't quite sort of pan out, whereas with this now, it's interesting because, I mean, Sin and Punishment, as I said before, the parallel is that decoupled movement and shooting. You know, you shoot independent of where your character was dodging around on the screen. Now, of course, the thing about a typical kind of Star Fox in a Punishment Space Harrier kind of game is it's 3D in the sense that, you know, you kind of go into the screen or whatever, the graphics might be polygonal in the case of Star Fox, but it's kind of essentially 2D in the way you play it. But once you go to all range mode, now you're talking truly three-dimensional stuff. And to decouple the movement and the shooting in that scenario really is kind of bold choice. But I think it is what makes it interesting now. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how much they push it with the rest of the game. I mean, the only thing I would say from my impression so far is that even though it's a good thing that they've made these sections more challenging, more interesting based on what they've set up with the controls, I do still wonder whether they'll end up being a bit too much of the game for my liking. You know, I still do like the traditional roller coastery kind of journey of a Star Fox game the most. That's what it is to me. That's mm-hmm. what it's always been. That should always be the meat of it. And so far, especially because bosses are all been fought, even in a linear sort of stage, in this all range kind of thing at the end of it, I kind of worry that maybe they're not quite going to get enough of that sort of classic Star Fox type of design out of it, which would be a shame. But at least, you know, I mean, this, you know, for all the talk about how much it's rehashing, you know, Star Fox 64 and all that kind of stuff, kind of going for nostalgia or whatever else, playing it safe. You know, the fact is that I think it's really commendable what they've done with the controls in many ways, because, you know, it doesn't help them make the game look that pretty. You know, because they have to run it on two screens at 60 frames per second, so it kind of limits what they could do aesthetically.
Mm-hmm.
For the record, I still like the way it looks. I liked it the first time they showed it, and it looks better now. You know, I like the kind of clean, shiny, slightly sort of retro-y kind of look it's got going on, but I don't think it makes it very sexy in screenshots and trailers for a lot of people either. But, you know, they've done that for a gameplay reason. I find that commendable as a general point. Whether the game design really supports that, though, is yet to be seen. But it's off to a good start. I'm enjoying it so far.
Yeah, just I really wish. I think that they should have kept the two kind of styles of gameplay, the kind of the roller coaster corridor shooter segments and the all range segments separate. I mean, like, in terms of control.
Yeah.
I feel
they could have, I feel like they could have done that. I mean, I mean, because you can, when you play the sort of more traditional style of progression parts of the game, almost forget about the other screen. You know, you can to an extent, but not quite all the way. Because there's still the thing about sometimes, even if you are shooting what you think is straight in front of you, you're not quite, because it has got that little bit of extra sort of nuance and accuracy with how you move in the gamepad, even in those bits. So in that sense, it's not as immediate at that point. And I just don't think it's as, you know, like, I'm not really seeing exactly what it's doing for those parts of the game so much yet.
Yeah.
So I think that's something I consider too, whether perhaps it should have just been separated altogether.
Yeah, because to me the control scheme makes sense when you're talking about a tank or a biped thing, like where you can be stationary and you control a turret on legs, and the legs can go, or the treads can go independently, you know, in one direction, and your turret aims somewhere else. Like, that makes sense. But in terms of a jet fighter or an R-wing, you know, it doesn't.
No, then you are to have a talk about a sort of Millennium Falcon type situation, which the R-wing is not.
Where two people, you know, are manning one is piloting and someone else.
You have a separate gunner, which is the co-op mode, I guess, with this. But in universe, you know, it's a one man fighter, so it doesn't really make too much sense.
It's got sophisticated AI. It's fine.
I mean, the one thing I would say about having played with the gyro wing, that's been bagged on plenty in reviews, and I could kind of see why, because it does seem like a kind of paddling type of level. You know, this very slow kind of level. I mean, I kind of had fun toying around with the gyro wing and to get into the grips with the controls, and it was kind of fun little toy type of experience. But the thing I'm concerned about with that is replay, because it's very slow, and once the novelty's worn off, I just don't. Yeah, that's so much of Star Fox, is replaying levels, you know, to get medals or to find other things or whatever. And I'm just, if there's, I don't know anything about unlocking like different things or whatever, so you know, I'm not sure about this. But if there was a situation where, you know, I needed to unlock like an expert mode or something by getting medals on that level, that would not be something I'd probably enjoy all that much if I'm playing it for the nth time or whatever. I think it's a one-off. It's one thing, but after that, I don't know. I'm dubious.
It strikes me a little bit as like the toys in, we talked about like the WarioWare games, like, hey, this thing works really well on this control, let's just try it and put it in there. My concern is it more, there's two modes that really
a weird thing for a system that's supposedly months away from having its production line.
Yeah, I know, it's kind of crazy. It strikes me as quite noteworthy that in the N64 game, there are two modes that kind of fit that description. There's the landmaster fights, and then there's the submarine fight. And the landmaster still manages to keep the verve of what Star Fox is. Like, the landmaster train pursuit is a really cool level.
It's a great level. Isn't that Johnny's favorite level in anything ever or something?
I think he said
that once.
It's because it's got this really intense, like, cadence to it. There's stuff happening all the time, whereas the underwater level just feels dark and moody and like just the pace doesn't feel right for the game.
So slow.
The pace is just wrong. And it makes sense because like we can do this. We can kind of do this weird like stuff popping out of the darkness and things that we really couldn't do with the old kind of 3D models of the Super Nintendo game. So let's just show it off. But it doesn't feel right. So when I saw the gyrocopter, my first thought was, all right, is it Landmaster or is it the sub? And it sounds like it's the sub, which is the reason there's only one of those stages in that game.
And to come back to the point of the kind of the pace killing of the gyro, that's one of the things that was brought up in the US Gamer review. Kat Bailey was down with the controls and everything, but she was like, surprisingly, it doesn't seem to be, I'm not really that interested in replaying the game because you have to go through these gyro levels every time. Enter.
Well, but that's the thing though. It does seem, I haven't even finished one run through yet, as I said, so I obviously I'm not that well versed about everything yet, but it does seem like you could just play missions on their own at this point. You know, you're not actually having to go through an entire run the way you did in Star Fox 64 just to play a level. Now in Star Fox 64 3D there was a separate score attack mode where you could play levels separately, which is why I really like that game, that version of the game.
Does that let you unlock alternate paths?
Yeah, you could just play there was a separate score attack mode, so you had to have unlocked the level in that already, and then the point is, say for instance, if you just wanted to play Macbeth because it was your favorite level in anything ever, then you could just do it, you know, without having to get there first, you know. So I mean, that was a really nice thing, and it does seem like you can just go back and play a specific level with this even without it being sort of in a separate score attack mode. So hopefully, you know, I can replay all the other levels a lot and get medals on those and be happy with that rather than, you know, the gyro thing, because I get the appeal, but I don't see it being something that you'd be willing to go through that lengthy process, you know, multiple times. It feels like once you've seen it, you've seen it. You know, there's kind of a stealth element to it and kind of exploring. I mean, once you know the level, you know, it's not going to have the same kind of high score appeal as all the other levels.
Gotcha. That's
so
a bummer,
now the reviews for this game have been contentious, to say the least. Well, the ones that actually
When the outlet bothered to finish reviewing it?
Correct. Now, who do you think this game is not for, Greg? Who do you think... because there's obviously some people out there that, let's just say the controls are a bridge too far for them.
Yeah.
Who do you think those people are?
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to say because, I mean, you might think they're not for you, and then if you actually got to try it, maybe it would surprise you, and you might think you were open-minded and then try it and go, fuck this shit. I mean, you don't know, do you? You don't know. Until, that's it. I mean, I was always open-minded, and so far, I think it's going pretty well. But I've always had a pretty high tolerance for sort of different kinds of controls, you know. I mean, just like, you know, I'm fine with the restrictions of Super Ghouls and Ghosts. I love the first Sin and Punishment. You know, I've always felt like if the game design demonstrates the rationale behind it and really exploits, you know, what that design offers, then it's all worth it, you know, that it makes sense. So it's really not to look at the controls on their own. It's important because there's just a simple joy, you know, the simple fun of, you know, that play aspect, like the toy kind of aspect of just messing around with this stuff kind of on a tactile level. But for me, that's, you know, only half the story. It's really got to be how that works with the design that they've set up, and you know, it's very difficult to predict how people are going to come down on that in general. I don't know whether like a demo would be a good idea to alleviate people, you know, maybe, you know, to give people a chance, and maybe it would alleviate some of their concerns. But then when you read some of the reviews, it's like, well, it took me this many hours to get used to it, and it's like, well, I don't know whether the demo
wouldn't
be such a good idea. So yeah, I really don't know. I mean, like, one thing I can say is it definitely feels very well suited to me personally. Yeah. But in terms of who it's not suited for, I wouldn't presume.
I mean, would you compare it to, say, the gyro controls in Splatoon? Because when I first played those, I was like, fuck this. But eventually, I came around and became my preferred style of play. I just had to actually sit down and play through a little bit and kind of see, you know, how I could, you know, use it to my advantage and wound up really liking it.
There's some parallels there. Obviously, you know, first of all, just in the type of input we're talking about, the recalibration factor as well is, you know, similar in terms of that could be something like, really, you know, do I want to be pressing something every so often? But once you get in a kind of in the groove of it and you know when it's starting to slide off a bit, you know, you just regularly recalibrate and you stop thinking about it. So there's similarities there, but the difference here is the two screens. That is the whole, and I think it's a different kind. It's not just about your physical interaction with the gamepad. It's about training your eyes. It's about kind of thinking more three dimensionally. And it's about like when to look at which screen and what circumstance. Like I said, for me, what I've been doing so far is kind of, you know, getting to a situation where it's like, okay, the shot is going to be sort of roughly lined up. Once I move the ship into position on the TV screen, then look at the gamepad and bang, 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 get the shot in and then look back up again, you know. So it's, you know, but other people may have great success, you know, doing it rather differently. I don't know. But, you know, like I said, I think there's some parallels there, but the two screen stuff really does, it makes it its own thing. Cool. So you might only have it might be a compound issue. Some people, just like kind of as you alluded to with Splatoon, have an issue with the idea of gyro controls in general. Mm-hmm. And then you compound that with this whole second screen stuff. I think it probably will be a non-starter for a fair few people. And that's just the way it is. You know, it's not going to, I admire the fact that they're willing to make a game that surely they know from their internal testing or whatever. A lot of people won't necessarily get immediately on with, but you know, but they go forward with it anyway because it actually gives it a fresh kind of feel and does open up the functionality of some of this all range stuff that they've done before. I think it's I don't know how commercially wise it is, but it's bold, and I like the fact that Nintendo are still willing to do stuff like that when they're so routinely accused of being, you know, dumbing this down and make it easier and this, that, and the other. You know, that there's still a bit of zag to go with that zig.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think on that, we're going to have to call it. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about with Star Fox Zero in the next couple weeks as more of us, well, at least one more of us, gets our chance to play this game and Greg gets deeper into it.
Yeah, should have it for the weekend.
As more as two more of us get this game and have time to talk about it. But on that, it's time for return of your regularly scheduled listener mail. Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have site news! Nintendo World Report Patreon campaign. You know that money you have that makes you say, I could give this to a homeless guy down the block, but I wish I'd get a return on my investment more tangible than goodwill towards man. Have we got a deal for you? For just a few dollars a month, you can subscribe and get access to exclusive NWR content and support one of the oldest Nintendo sites on the net. Do the right thing. I mean,
right. What's right? I mean,
yeah, what is right? What is your own moral compass say?
Yeah.
I will say RFN, cast and crew get none of this money.
Yeah.
So, you're not giving it to us. If you want to give us money, we've got an email inbox, just email us.
We'll work something out.
Yeah, I've got an account you can put it in.
Mm-hmm. It's offshore, of course.
It's in Aruba.
Panama papers and all that, you know.
The deposit account is in Aruba. I'm not going to say where the money goes after that.
True.
Speaking of following the money, we have a review of Star Fox Zero on Wii U by Neil Ronahan. Little known fact, Neil cannot walk in one direction and turn his head in another. With Star Fox Zero, he is finally able to live the fantasy by flying his R-Wing while looking around and aiming with the gamepad. Check out his review and read the words of a man weeping with joy.
Tears are on the page. Tears are on the page.
Which is amazing because it's digital.
Yep. right, and we have a review of Star Fox Guard. Hey, it's Star Fox Week here at NWR. For Wii U by John Reardon. This game is a pack-in with Star Fox Zero, but is it worthwhile as a standalone purchase on the eShop? The eternal question. John answers that question for you and also provides an in-depth rundown of all the modes in this quirky Star Fox spinoff.
You know, does one of the modes involve taking pictures with the gamepad and then, like, making yourself look like an anthropomorphic character?
Business, man.
Business!
Right.
Business!
And we have a review of Tachyon Project for Wii U by Don Koopman, of course. Don and the phrase twin-stick shooter go hand-in-hand, so of course he was first in line to review Tachyon Project. That's totally untrue. We don't have a lineup for anything, especially on Wii U. He answers the eternal question, is this the Wii U's Geometry Wars? Well, maybe not, but is it better than tested with robots? Never forget. Never forget tested with robots.
Never forgive, never forget.
Yeah.
You can never forgive us right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. It's time for listener mail. You can send us your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We will then sort them into a bucket that I have in my inbox called emails to use. And then when I use them, they'll move into a bucket called email that I have used. That's how I keep things in order, just in case you want to know how I sort my email personally.
A peek behind the curtain. It's as magical as I imagined, perhaps even more.
It's everything Guillaume had ever wanted. That's all I can say. And first up this week, Bilbert writes, I read that correctly.
Yes.
Seeing as how third-party support on Nintendo home consoles has been complete shit for the last two generations, do you think Nintendo should strike a deal with third-party publishers to port the games themselves? It wouldn't be the first time this has happened in the industry. I believe Sega did this with their 8 and 16-bit consoles.
Yeah, they did with, like, the Master System, and that was because the Master System was kind of a disaster.
The Master System is a 2-bit console.
But they did that also because Nintendo had, like, these really, really... because, you know, they were in the position of power, and they had these deals with, like, you know, they could make other publishers money. But, you know, they controlled what went on the Famicom or not. So, you know, they would force kind of exclusivity deals on these publishers. Right? That's part of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also just the fact that, you know, like, while it might not have been, say, for instance, that worthwhile potentially to Capcom to put, like, Ghouls and Ghosts on the Genesis Mega Drive themselves, if Sega come along and pay them a fee, say, well, we'll do the work and put your game on here and you'll get a cut and all that kind of thing, you know, that helped them sort of fill out the early Genesis Mega Drive kind of lineup. And, you know, it did help that console get a foothold in the market. And ultimately, you know, they had pretty decent third-party support, especially, you know, in American sort of territory, on an autonomous basis eventually. So I mean, that is, you know, I guess what Bilbert is kind of saying here, that somehow you could kind of like seed this kind of stuff. But obviously that was a very different time, in terms of how costly games were to port or make or anything like that. And also the importance of the arcade scene, you know, like they were, you know, porting, you know, most of the time popular arcade games, you know, and trying to get like the best home port that there was to date, you know, for an affordable system. Now, you know, with this case, we're talking about porting stuff that's already on other home consoles. I don't think it necessarily has the same sort of potential to inspire interest in the system.
Yeah, well, and at that point, there was already sort of this weird... best way to describe this. There were essentially two Western video game markets at this point. There was all the weird shit going on in Europe. And then there was sort of this, like, very defined console space that existed in North America. Whereas in Europe, you had all these home computers that were all very different in what they were capable of. And all of them had these sort of, like, third-party ports of you know, Capcom games,
US
games.
US Gold was the label US Gold, that brought all that stuff.
Quite possibly the greatest crime any English people have ever committed against the Americas is US Gold.
It's up there.
Because there's no gold or US in US Gold. Nope. Also, by the way, US Gold, now Eidos, just so you know.
It's square. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially, you can trace the lineage of all those U.S. Gold Olympics games to Square Enix now. Because all these systems were so very different, nobody was going to sit there and make Streets of Rage ports for whatever crazy Z-Log Z80 home computer you had. Nobody's going to go out there and bother to make a Spectrum version of Final Fight. Well, we'll do it. We'll put it out on Spectrum and we'll put it on a disc and sell it for the $2.99 collection. And as you can imagine, there was sort of a bad kind of taste that this left in the original publisher's mouth. Because you can imagine that how much effort was put into a £2.99 version of Final Fight for the Spectrum.
No,
five colors at a time anyway.
It's a lot of story to it. It's like Factor 5 basically got started by like doing knockoff R-Type or something. I think it's something like that, isn't it? They were basically cloning games for European computers, and that's they got their start, and then eventually they're doing their own stuff like Turrican.
They actually were so bad at making games, and I'm not kidding, at doing these knockoffs, that they created a second company name just to hide their bad games. And in fact, the very first video game that came out in homes that has Sonic in it is a knockoff game because they saw art for him in a magazine and just knocked him off. It's a game they gave away for free in a magazine for one of these European home computers.
All right. So back in the day, these computers had very different architecture and whatever. And so like these ports were, I don't know. Yeah. Right. It was like,
they made business sense.
It made business sense to port them, but also it was a lot of work. But then the games were more simple than today. So
now you've seen these hardware sort of converge, and there's expectation that versions are the same across the platform, and when they're not, it's a pretty significant problem.
Yeah, the hardware is more uniformized.
Even when they weren't last generation, or even more so the generation prior, where you had essentially three platforms all doing three different things, the expectations were uniform. There was an expectation that the game, if I'm playing True Crimes LA, just as a game I pulled out of my ass, on my Xbox versus my PS2 versus my GameCube, the PS2 one's going to look more janky, the GameCube one's going to look kind of in the middle, and the Xbox one's going to look a little bit better, but they're all going to be kind of in the same ballpark from each other. They're going to work the same way. You're going to get similar experience. Whereas even on the Genesis Super Nintendo era, you could have vastly different experiences with the same game, even though they may wear the same name. Go play Street Fighter on Genesis. It's terrible.
Well, same thing with the EA NHL hockey games. I hated the ones on the Super Nintendo because they just didn't feel the same. They played slower.
Right.
Yeah, well, right. That's true. Yeah.
And that wouldn't fly now. So ultimately, I don't think a publisher would want Nintendo making ports of their games, because best case scenario for them is it feels the same. There's no difference. But the worst case is either it's way worse or possibly it's better and they look stupid.
What's Nintendo that game called? The Dead Something, Chop Till You Drop?
No, Dead that's Rising. Worst case. Chop till
Dead
you
Rising.
Drop. Yeah.
That's the worst case scenario.
Chop till
it's
you
happened.
Drop this disc in the trash can.
Yeah.
I would say the bigger issue, though, is one of Nintendo's weaknesses is they don't have the dev resources.
No, I mean, you'd be talking about, what you'd be talking about is a situation where you made a deal with a third party and then farmed out the work on that deal to someone else.
Tantalus making your ports of your PS4 games.
What that actually makes me think of is Twin Snakes. They made that deal with Konami, but then had Silicon Knights actually make the actual sort of work to make that particular remake of Metal Gear Solid a GameCube exclusive or whatever. So that's the kind of thing they've done. But I think that's they've done things like kind of rescue games that otherwise would not get published. So on the one hand, that gives you Devil's Third. On the other hand, it gives you Bayonetta 2. So it's, you know,
Steve!
Rough with the smooth, divine and the profane, however you want to say it.
Steve Hewitt is Devil's Third, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but now, anyway, like earlier, like the point I was getting at is that we use the UD one out, so it's kind of harder to port stuff to it. And they just didn't really play along with the rest of the industry, and so like they don't have the engines that are widely used. Like, it took a while to even get Unity on the Wii U and then the new 3DS and Unreal. Well, like,
and
then,
there's a whole armature having to do this.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, we had to wait until Bloodstained had the Kickstarter and then reached an insane stretch goal, and so they could farm out the port to Armature, who are going to adapt the Unreal Engine to the Wii U. And that's going to come out, like, supposedly in 2017, but
at a time when the Wii U may well be firmly in its own grave.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make that game. Yeah, and I don't think it's going to make that target date, you know, so.
Yeah, well, both Mighty Number 9's an indication.
Oh, all right. Don't speak ill of the dead here, Greg.
The first thing that they've got to do to address this stuff is, you know, if they're serious about addressing this stuff, they do need to have a platform architecture that's not such an outlier.
They have to play nice with the other big dogs in the industry. You know, they have to please the Unreal guys. They have to please, like, whoever is making these big engines. And because that's way easier than, you know, this roundabout way that we just mentioned with Bloodstained. Like,
yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, I think as long as there's so much many more extra hoops to jump through, yeah, they could only ever do really sort of limited interventions, you know, in that kind of space. And, you know, I think you try and target stuff that you feel could have the most impact, you know, and they might still do stuff. I mean, there's a certain amount of rumours about Beyond Good and Evil 2, and that kind of kicking around the idea that they might step in to make that happen as an excuse for that. You know, that's the kind of thing you could see them do, but it's just the odd thing. It's not the kind of thing that's really going to give you that. What we're really talking about with the deficient third-party support is more, you know, the depth of games in the library to really fill it out, and to some extent the breadth as well. You have certain genres that Nintendo doesn't really kind of dabble with, or they don't have partners that do it for them or whatever. So, you know, it just, that can only come organically rather than, you know, Nintendo doing, you know, some 5-year plan Soviet stuff to try and get, you know, it's got to be an inviting marketplace for people to come and make games in.
Building Iwatograd, is that what you're saying?
Oh my god.
Oh god. So is this where we put the NX disclaimer? We don't know what the NX is, etc. Save us from this tasteless joke that John has made.
It remains relevant, doesn't it? The fact that we don't know what it is. I mean, there's certain expectations building up about the kind of architecture it might have, about how powerful it might be and all that, and we don't really know how
it's Z-Log Z80.
Yeah, we don't know how sort of grounded in fact that is yet, or how, you know, it's tough to say, but that's got to be the first part. And then the second part, as I guess, has got to be, maybe they could, like I said, do some targeted kind of moves to make it seem like, hey, you know, we are going to do some things that are going to kind of push it to our kind of loyalist consumers, maybe in certain cases, so that you don't get this. Yeah, the vicious circle has been, as well as the technical stuff, the vicious circle has been, well, you know, however many units of a Nintendo console there are out there, and there were very many Wii units out there, there were very many DSs out there, you know, then the problem is these people just care about Nintendo titles. That's what they buy, that's what they play, that's all they're there for. So it just, you know, there's no point. So I think the one thing they could do, in addition to just making it a technically relatively sort of hassle-free process and you know, competitive on cost terms, is a few targeted sort of things where it's like, okay, yeah, you know, we're sort of taking this under our wing a little bit, you know, and they've done it, you know, on 3DS with Japanese games, they've done it. You know, Monster Hunter, I think, would be the prime example. You know, money's changed hands, and they've tried to push it and stuff, and you know, they've put Nintendo, they've put Nintendo character DLC in Monster Hunter and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, they've really helped push it, and they've had some success with doing that outside of Japan at this point. I think the real issue is if you want to sort of broaden out third-party support on a Nintendo platform, they've got to start doing that more with Western publishers. You know, it seems like mm-hmm. they're sort of networking. Yeah. Their networking does do some good things in Japan. We get the stuff with Platinum. We get collaborations with Capcom and all this kind of stuff. You had Twin Snakes in the past involving Konami. But when you're talking about, you know, outside of that sort of closed circuit or whatever, the Japanese gaming sort of industry, they don't seem plugged in nearly the same way. So
yeah, that's a Nintendo thing. That's not a Japanese North American thing, because Sony has no problem with it.
Sony does run part of their business out of America too, which helps.
They handle studios perhaps a little bit more closely. Like Nintendo of America used to with Rare and other teams, other developers, but they seem to have pulled that back a little bit. You know,
Sony's much more an international company.
Yeah,
I don't buy that.
I mean, Nintendo doesn't do anything but games. So, like, you could make the counter argument that. Oh, Sony, that they don't, that if they didn't support the third parties as well, you could say, oh, well, Sony does a whole bunch of other stuff. Nintendo doesn't do anything but video games, so why do they underserve third parties to the degree that they do? You know, or why do they alienate third parties to the degree that they do in North America?
No, but that's the thing. That's the thing. You've got to draw a contrast as well. I mean, when Bill Butt talks about the situation has been bad, and you know, there's a lot of different reasons for that. You know, if you go all the way back to the N64, you know, and maybe even before that, you know, there was almost like active alienation going on. You know, there was the Dream Team with the N64. I mean, that's pretty much what it was, which is just astonishing, really. But I get mostly a case of them just overplaying their hand. You know, be conceited, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't been like that for a while now, I wouldn't say, but they don't, at the same time, they haven't sort of managed to break away from those sorts of perceptions and that kind of, you know, inertia that came out of the N64 era leading into the GameCube. They haven't been able to make the really sort of big moves to decisively get out of the shadow of that stuff by, you know, being more proactive with Western publishers and all that. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm probably glossing over things they have done here. This is
you have like the Amiibo Skylander Activision things. Like they have situations where they work really well with some companies. It's just there is a market and a perception problem there. Now, one thing that I think will change a bit with NX, but this is more of a Japanese side of things, is games are incredibly expensive to make right now. And ultimately, if you are making games, you want to put them out on everything because you don't want to miss out on any incremental sales if it's easy to do so. So when you had Square Enix's head going out there talking about NX versions of games when the NX was mostly theoretical. Like, that's primarily because there's a business reality that, like, this thing needs to run.
Especially with some of the stuff that Square's doing where the costs are just running. So you want to amortize that.
This game's been in development for 14 years, damn it. anyway. I think it's time for the next email.
Sure.
John.
All right. Let me hold on. Okay. Capsule J writes, "Dear Arf and crew, I was recently discussing the casual versus classic, i.e. permadeath modes, in the two most recent Fire Emblem games with a friend. He was telling me that he always opts for casual because for him the relationship building element of the game is a key feature." And
kind of struggling with that phrase.
Yeah. "Is a key feature, and therefore permanently killing off a character runs contrary to the game's design. I, on the other hand, find that playing with permadeath disabled tends to break the game tends to break the game from a strategic standpoint, since there's nothing stopping you from sending your characters on suicide missions. We ultimately concluded that some kind of intermediate setting that punishes killing a character without permanently removing them from the game would be ideal. Where do you guys land with this? Also, are there any other games that you guys enjoy that have mechanics that seem to be at odds with each other like this?
Yeah, like this is a question basically about playing a game the way it's meant to be played. Yeah,
right.
I don't know.
What is that?
Yeah, what is that? It's a good question. So, like, well, go ahead.
I was going to say, we kind of had this conversation when I was talking about how just brain dead easy Birthright is. And one of the things that I mentioned is kind of doing this to myself, where if I lose a character, which is pretty uncommon, but if I lose a character playing it in casual, I basically said, well, I can't use them for X number of missions. And it was kind of a loose rule, but it was like, how idiotic was I when I lost them? I was a blithering idiot. They're benched for three or four missions. Like, was it just a situation where, like, the game dice rolled me and it was like, okay, fuck you.
Yeah, like, okay. That's a bit that. I mean, I kind of like making your own rules in games. I talked about this when I played through Bravely Second. Like, I had my own rules about, you know, I'd have the random encounters on when I was exploring a dungeon for the first time, you know, kind of mapping it out. But then after that, it was purely whether I wanted it on or not. You know, just these little, what's that old Pokemon thing about Nuzlocke or whatever?
You can make your own rules
to a large extent these days. That's kind of how I approach Fire Emblem. I talked about this when we did the Sacred Stones retroactive, in terms of, you know, if I was, if I did something that was just really careless and stupid or whatever, you know, then I would probably restart, because I just, you know, that's just me tripping on a banana skin or whatever. But if someone died for a good cause, then they could stay dead. You know, that was an honorable sacrifice. If I played the battle pretty well and, you know, got a hard won sort of victory and someone had to pay the price, then I was quite fine accepting that. So again, I get the point about the fact that, yeah, maybe just like being absolute one way or the other is a bit kind of, imperfect, you know, but you can always kind of, you know, make your own restrictions as long as you adhere to them.
I think you have the situation in Fates, where they've added this other mode, this other setting beyond casual.
Phoenix mode, isn't it?
Where they come back after a few turns. It's like, well, shit. Like, you'd have to literally just get nuked to lose in that mode, because they basically take it away if the main character dies this mission over as well. So, like, you'd have to really, really F up to lose in that mode. And I just, like, that part feels a bit much, but the fact that they put it in does lend some credence to Capsule J's friend's point that the relationship building element, regardless of how difficult that is for John to say, is a core conceit of the game. Like,
I think it's identified with the big sales spike with Awakening, wasn't it? You know, especially and that is the game that, you know, from everything we hear, like, saved the franchise from oblivion. It's not surprising that they put things, you know, put more options in that cater to that point of view, that is a central kind of element.
I mean, they essentially
the
made a whole game version for it.
Yeah.
Like, that is Birthright.
Yeah, that is where it's most central. And then I guess, yeah, it's not nearly so central in Conquest, seemingly, although still haven't had the pleasure. Still got, like, what, another 3 weeks until it comes out in Europe or something?
God, that's insane. It is, but, I mean, I see the strain here. Like, there is kind of this, and, you know, when I played Awakening, like, it was my fourth Fire Emblem, maybe my fifth. Like, I've played a lot of these games, and I didn't really perceive the push pull there. Like, I got that by having this sort of like double layer of persistence in the characters, that losing them becomes doubly impactful, because ultimately you not only lost that character, you potentially lost another character that they would have been, you know, the parent of.
Yeah.
So the impact would be fairly severe, especially in Awakening, where the second generation of characters have so much higher potential ceilings than the first generation characters. In Fates, that seems to have been sanded down a bit. Like, there's definitely a gulf there. Like, the second generation characters are stronger, but it's not so immediately apparent that the parent is, you know, essentially completely inferior in every respect. But it's, the push-pull is much more apparent in Birthright. For whatever reason, like, seeing the writing is on the wall that, like, they understood there's a conflict here. And that many mechanisms of this game serve to prevent that conflict from being unmanageable for people who really like this element of it. So for me, the it just ends up being a convenient shorthand to have the ability to essentially this character self-revive after every battle, because I was the kind of obsessive who would go back and replay his missions, which I never had a problem with when I screwed up, like when it was my fault. But when it was, you know, like I said, when it was dice rolls, it was just like, well, I don't, this bothers me immensely.
Yeah, that definitely sits uneasily a little bit, I think, there's the cruel twist of fate of where, you know, the weapon triangle's in your favor or whatever, but somehow it all goes
and
he
double
wrong.
Criticals. It's like, oh, great, thanks. Yeah, yeah. Or it'd be like a dumb story trigger where, like, suddenly the game has, like, a trigger event driven by if you step on this square, and for whatever reason, like, you sent one party on ahead and just suddenly 20 enemies show up. Well, he's fucked. That's the end of this.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That, there's always
say,
something
I mean,
that,
I wouldn't have, like, an absolutely, like, just restart every time everyone dies kind of rule, but I don't know, the way I play Fire Emblem is kind of like the way I play a classic action game in a way, in terms of some of it, at least, is feeling out the level, because stuff happens, you know, like you said, you do get other units just emerging out of, you know, somewhere, you know, it's not always that transparent. So, you know, if you will get people dying, it's kind of, well, you know, no amount of strategy could have prepared me for that, you know, like, or something like that.
I don't really, you know, I don't really have much to say about Fire Emblem, but this question to me, like, what the franchise that comes to mind is Metroid, because it's not so much maybe within the same game, but within the series, the aim or the way that it's meant to be played seems to vary wildly. You know, we've got the NES game and the Super Nintendo game where and the Game Boy game to some extent, where some sequence breaking is kind of expected or, you know, kind of planned, but there's also probably more sequence breaking than the developer anticipated because of exploits, bug exploits, that stuff like that. But then you get to Metroid Prime, and yes, they got kind of the feeling of Super Metroid kind of right in 3D, but the game is so much longer and sequence breaking is not nearly as much a part of the game as in the 2D games. And
yeah, I mean, I think there's crazy things that people have done, but it's not like,
yeah,
I think
like
it's less kind of accessible, I assume, you know,
right,
because
like you can't infinitely bomb jump. I know there was like some sort of exploit, some jump exploit that people used in the US version on the GameCube to do some sequence breaking, but that flaw, that bug was fixed in subsequent releases, like I think in the European version or the Wii trilogy version.
Yeah.
So they go out of their way. The developer went out of their way to clamp down on that. So yeah, like it's really, I don't know, it's an interesting question, because like if you like the series, if you like Metroid because of the sequence breaking, because you want to see exactly just how far you can push it with how few items you can finish the level, the game, then, yeah, like, if you're working against the developer like that, or the developer is working against you,
that's kind of an interesting tension. Because you do get Metroid games very explicit, you know, like Zero Mission has a bunch of different endings based on, well, you completed it this quickly, but maybe like a really low percentage item run and all that. You know, it's very much like baked into the cake once you get to that point. Whereas, yeah, maybe other places, it's you know, with the console games, it wasn't. I mean, in more general sort of Metroid example, I mean, I think of, you know, people, we talked about this related to an email a few weeks ago, Metro Prime 2, the whole, you know, the atmosphere hurts you thing, you know, I mean, it is, and just the safe zones, you know, with the crystals, it's a game series that's based on exploration, and yet you have this mechanic that's very much about the sort of limits your exploration very constantly. And I mean, you know, yes, I know what they're going for there in terms of differentiating the Dark Worlds, you know, as an experience, I think, you're trying to make it seem more substantively different than just the purple haze or whatever. So,
right.
All around you. But yeah, it did feel, you know, to put it in the terms from the email, at odds with the core of Metroid, which is moving around the environment, kind of, I don't know whether unencumbered is quite the right word, but you know what I mean. You know, the freedom was gone in the Dark World, and that was the point. Like, that's not an accident. Like, that is what they were going for, but it was at odds with the traditional kind of concept of Metroid, in my opinion.
Fusion kind of explicit, like they just blocked your way constantly and prevented you from exploring constantly. Yeah. That was kind of the start of it.
And then by extension, Other M has some similar things because it's a very similar game in a lot of ways.
I'm going to speak to the one that right now one former host of the show is probably thinking of, which is the original Sonic the Hedgehog game, which is this game where it takes a while to get to speed. That's one of the things about the first game people forget, is you don't have that, like, insta-start dash.
Spin dash, charge on the spot.
The levels are quite thick in the first Sonic game versus the later games, where they become much more of a rail. Like, essentially, there's a high rail, low rail, and a medium rail. And a lot of times, you end up having to kind of poke your way through. So once you get up to speed, which takes much longer in that game, you have to stop, slow down, and figure out where you're going. And it kind of sucks. That game kind of sucks. And that's kind of why. Like it's just, the conceit seemed to be, man, look how fast he can go, but they hadn't figured out how to make a level about how fast he can go.
Yeah, see, I kind of think the same thing in a way about, like, some of the F-Zero games, where, like, you just really, really want to blaze through something, but they throw, like, some crazy curves at you, and it's just like, don't.
Literally,
dead stop. Dead stop. So frustrating, you know? And that's kind of the point. Yeah, it's like, that's the point of the game, I get it, but, man, it's like, sometimes I'm just like, can't you just throw a really easy track at me? Like, come on. Like, I don't consider it a design flaw, but I mean...
Darren pictured Baby Park as an F-Zero track. Kind of like the way, you know, the way Rainbow Road got way faster when it was in F-Zero X than Mario Kart 64? Like, Baby Park gets F-Zero Y, so like a lap takes half a second.
Oh, yeah. God.
That's what I'm imagining.
But see, that would be actually pretty funny.
Just imagine how fast the band from Mario Kart 8 would have to play to make that work.
Race over. Race is done. Race has been completed. Yeah, it's. But yeah, like, to your point, like, there in F-Zero GX, there are tracks that you just have to know there's a hole there.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be going, according to the game, 1,000 kilometers an hour.
Yep.
And you take a turn, and suddenly the track's not finished because the race organizers are cheap assholes. It's like,
I think it's more of an issue when it's strung together in a Grand Prix mode and you've got limited lives.
Yes.
I mean, in general, I don't feel like it's at odds with the concept of a racing game, as we said when we did the retroactive on
FUX. It's kind of the point to learn the track, right?
Racing games is about learning tracks, but when you have the whole thing of stringing 6 of them together, unlimited lives, and that Lakitu isn't coming to save you and all that kind of stuff, like, then I feel like it's more that stuff that's at odds with the racing rather than, like, the track design per se. But certainly, yeah, they don't fit that well together at times with GX in that way. I think that's a fair point.
Another one I'd point out, and this is a game that I absolutely adore, is specifically the Ogre Battle 64, but it goes to the JRPGs as a whole, where there's a lot of character development stuff, and a lot of the game is about building the characters to suit your need. It's just that game, you have to build a lot of characters to suit your need. There's always sort of like a finite, unless you want to sit there and just grind forever, there's a finite amount of opportunity to build out your character. So while the game is going to reward you for experimenting and trying a lot of different stuff, ultimately, the only way to really be successful at that is to just go online and go, okay, what's a good character build? Help, please.
Yeah.
Help to do. Actually, a lot of the Western RPGs have an even worse version of that problem, where you can just break your character and they suck. because you didn't set your points up the right way, and that sucks.
Yeah, it does suck.
So, any others? We want to move on.
Well, I just wonder. Just the one comment I'd like to make is, I wonder now, like with kind of the rise of speed running being a thing, I just wonder if it just in terms of game design, if this stuff will be more. I wouldn't say encouraged, but I just wonder if you'll see more of this stuff in game designs going forward. In other words, whereas maybe 20 years ago they might say, oh well, we can't have that because it runs counter to the game's design, and somebody could sequence break or something like that. If now, you know, I mean, just because I see certain games that kind of have speedrunning modes. You know?
Yeah, I think the big thing now is that everybody's sharing their experiences more.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people, you know, game designers can see kind of the unintended consequences or things, you know, these sort of contradictions in game design maybe manifest themselves in ways they wouldn't necessarily have anticipated. And then that feedback loop gets sort of factored in maybe with subsequent games. Yeah. You know, so it's a lot more rapid, and kind of organic kind of process that you've got now, rather than just in the old days, you know, I guess word of mouth still existed and everything,
yep.
but I'm sure it would have been much more of a kind of a percolation of things that would have gone into whether they felt like, you know, this was something that at first might have seemed like it was at odds with what they were trying to achieve, but actually it could be an intriguing way to, you know, make the experience more customizable, or, you know, more for accommodating of different preferences. You know, I mean, that's the thing with Fire Emblem. I don't know, maybe the original designers had very strong feelings about what was the right way to play the game. Maybe they didn't. But, you know, I think probably, you know, what they found now is that, you know, people can experience, you know, get a lot out of, you know, maybe certain aspects which were once thought of as peripheral. And so now that it's a lot more customizable than it ever was before, you know, because the fact is the whole, you know, death, permadeath thing, like that is a separate setting from how hard the game is, isn't it? You know, like you've got,
right.
You know, you could play, you know, Phoenix hard, or, you know, you could play, you know, sort of your classic easy. So it's open to what the different kinds of players actually want to see from it. So, you know, I think some interesting stuff could come out of these contradictions once you know how people respond to them.
All right, so next email, I believe this is Guillaume.
Yes, celebrity email. Leon S. Kennedy writes...
When he's not busy killing BOWs.
A major potential advantage of the NX, the home console version anyway, was that it would likely be more powerful than PS4 and Xbox One. Now, there are strong rumors of a more powerful PS4.5, which with 4K capabilities coming soon. Do you think this will do serious damage to the NX's chances of success? Is Sony coming out with the PS4.5 in reaction to the NX? Do you think Nintendo should have kept the entire idea of the NX a secret until it was formally announced, so that its competitors wouldn't be given so much time to react to it? I really don't think the PS4.5 is a reaction to what Nintendo was doing or to the revelation of possible specs of the NX. Because these companies are always working on the next iteration of their next, you know, completely new hardware as soon as they finish the previous one.
Yeah, there's a lot of things here I don't really get. I mean, forgive me for my ignorance or whatever, but I mean, don't we keep hearing about how PS4 is like selling at a much faster pace than the consoles of the previous generation were?
Yeah,
like a really weird thing to kind of do this DSi.
The Neo, yes.
The latest batch of rumors you got about this is the PS4 Neo, which we all want competing consoles to be anagrams of one another, obviously. it just beggars belief to me. It's like you need to, you know, kind of give sales shot in the arm when they're this good.
Just a strike the iron while it's hot kind of thing.
Maybe so.
But sometimes you break the iron.
I think maybe the mindset is that while people are buying PlayStation 4, PlayStation 4s now, they're buying PlayStation 4 games now we gotta kind of keep this momentum going. Let's give them fresh new hardware and let's keep them buying PlayStation 4.
I think they're afraid of like the console market softening because consoles have pretty much dropped off the map in Japan.
The thing. I mean, the Japanese thing is one, you know, is totally separate, isn't it? You know, like I said, I mean, on the one hand, you've got PS4 sales outside of Japan are just doing gangbusters and it's outpacing the last console cycle, not just outpacing where PS3 was, because obviously PS3 had a rocky start. I'm talking about outpacing your PS3 and 360 put together. You know, it's on a really, really good pace, even if you compare it to those, you know, the whole market in the last cycle. So it does seem a little bit odd, but, I imagine they have their reasons. Those reasons I can't imagine have much to do with Nintendo.
More to do with Apple than anything else. And what Apple does with their hardware.
Just broader market concerns. And also, you've got, that is where things are, the feeling is like that. I guess that's where things are going. You know, that it's not going to be a battle. Because you've had it with Xbox too, as well, haven't you? You know, that's been talked about a lot, that Xbox might do, you know, sort of incremental little, it's somewhat better, but it's not a whole new platform. Yeah, kind of what we've seen with Nintendo portables in the past, you know, DSi and the new 3DS, but actually now with home consoles, you know, that is the feeling it sure as hell feels like that's where we're going. And I think that's a lot more about just consumer electronics in general than it is about what Nintendo's got up its sleeve.
I think Sony is really trying to seize that there's nothing right now, except maybe PCs, that would take advantage of a 4K resolution. And Sony wants to sell you their 4K TVs right now. So I think they're trying to kind of get a head start and get
this
is how they
always end up buggering themselves up, though. I mean, you have the Blu-ray with PS3 and all that. Like, you know, how quickly can we get back to the hubris part of the wheel?
In the same cycle? Yeah, we can do that. Give us a second.
Now that I'm on top of the world, time to jump off the cliff. See you guys. Gone.
Like, the PlayStation 4, the PlayStation 4.5, I don't think is rumored to be getting completely new games. Like, I think it's supposed to get games that are optimized for 4K TVs and for VR, but it's not going to replace, supposedly, the PlayStation 4.
Well, so nope. I don't think VR is actually even mentioned in the now I would say the best reporting comes out of the Giant Bomb articles on it. Like, I think it's I don't think it's really about getting games running at 4K either so much. Like,
yeah,
I've really
heard that the specs aren't even really up to what 4K would require, right?
No.
Huh. I saw that
4K,
stated 4K
requires... So yeah, the CPU is not that much more powerful. Yeah. The GPU is quite a bit beefier, and there's... The RAM is larger, but like, it's not... Excuse me, the memory's larger, but it's not like a huge, giant bump. The biggest, I think it does, the output supports 4K, but that's also for 4K Blu-rays. I think the bigger issue is that Sony appears to be requiring that all games that come out have to have a base mode and a neo mode, and essentially all the core functionality has to work on both versions of the platform. I think this ultimately is the problem. I think because Sony has kind of a weird situation here. If news of this thing hadn't leaked when they just announced it, everybody who had bought a PS4 in, say, the previous 6 months pretty much has every right to just hate Sony forever at that point. But when it does leak, and it did, and it leaked because of GDC, because GDC is the eternal leak machine, like, I can't think of a faster way to careen sales of your current hardware to go, hey, there's a better one coming in like 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, unless they do it sort of like you know, something like the Xbox and the Xbox Elite, right? Where they're like, this is the premium model, and everything still works on the other one,
just,
but this is the premium model.
That was just hard drive space, though. This is like your game may operate better. The only scenario I could think of that really jumps out at me is the Jaguar models, where there was one model of Jaguar that operated
well.
The reason in that case was actually there was a hardware deficiency in the first design of that system, and they fixed it, so games actually performed correctly on late model Jaguars versus like the first third of the batches of Jaguars that were made. But beyond that, like, I can't think of a scenario where there is going to be split consoles where the console behaves better in one version than the other. And
yeah, you've had like you've had little differences with like revisions, like with there was the Mega Drive / Genesis 2 when the sound was a little different,
right.
And that's why with the 3D Classics M2 actually included the emulation for both sound styles, you know.
But that wasn't like a performance thing.
No,
that's a very unconsole thing to have happen in your system. It's like, well, there's now this weird split experience, and I wonder how many publishers are gonna actually be thrilled about this whole, like, you're saying we have to make two modes, insert two modes, and test two modes.
Yeah, and that's I think that might be again. That's where we come back to the hubris angle. It's like, yeah, maybe the why this is happening when PS4 is doing so well is they feel like they have the leverage to make these sorts of demands of developers without it really costing them, because they think they've bested Microsoft so thoroughly, and probably indeed are not afraid of whatever Nintendo has up their sleeve. You know, so again, circling back around to that point, I think I don't see a linkage. But I mean, this idea about, I mean, you know, the expectations that are being set now by the rumors about NX, you know, that it would be more powerful, at least, than the baseline PS4 and Xbox One. I mean, intuitively, I've never really expected that to be the case. I don't know, maybe just to be conditioned by all these, you know, cycles, that it just seems improbable. It doesn't seem what Nintendo would do, and, you know, the price is so important, you know, to making it competitive, and they're so Japan-centric, and, you know, the PS4, for all its success, is not light in Japan on fire. It still hasn't passed the Wii U in install base there yet, though I'm sure it will soon, because it's, you know, best in it on a weekly basis pretty healthily. It just, I don't see it, but that's what everybody's expecting at this point. Is there a danger that we're all going to be horribly disappointed?
So the PS4 is not, with respect to PCs, and the Xbox One even more so, isn't monstrously powerful. So if the real goal here was they're afraid of a stronger platform, it'd be tilting at PCs.
With the PS4, though, the PS4 kind of, its stake in the ground was that it was the most, it had the best hardware. It can do 1080p across the board, right? And I think that's what Sony wants to maintain more than anything.
Yeah,
right.
And
even though that's just fanboy, kind of like, you know, that's
it's dick waving, you know, 1080p dick waving.
Morpheus was in development because somebody loves Matrix Revelations at Sony.
Apparently, of course, right? Like, what if it's like a huge fucking? Oh god,
Morpheus was in development like before the PS4 came out.
The inevitable Trinity, what's that going to be?
Vita. Like,
to complete it's the Vita. Vita. Yeah.
There's already rumors of the next Vita, right?
It's already dead. There you go. Done. Finished.
Spoiler.
Morpheus was in development before the PS4 came out, and yet it still has to have the breakout box in order to achieve the performance that it needs. Like, there's definitely like a performance gap on the system that is just, it's not necessarily powerful enough for what they think it needs to do. There's no indication if the Neo, as fuck Sony, is calling it, like, needs this breakout box still or not. My guess is it probably will, because of compatibility with software. Like, it's coded to send stuff to that thing to do work.
And I mean, it may also, you know, maybe they would do a firmware update to it that could say, hey, you have the option to offload some of the VR work to the PS4.5.
Yeah, but like, even then, like, that may be built into the games itself. Like, you may have to patch all your, like, here's the thing. So because it's these game modes will have this enhanced version, like, you're not going to drop Fallout 4 in your PS4 Neo and it's not going to still play like ass, because it's still going to play like ass because Bethesda ain't going to do the work.
Well, I
That's
mean,
not
it,
their
you
game.
Would think anybody that wanted to take advantage of it would have to do like a patch for
they're gonna have
September
to, yeah.
or October, right? I mean, it's more work, so.
Right. They're going to have to do a patch, and like, so a lot of games that have shitty performance now are probably going to still have shitty performance on the system, because why would you go back and patch your game that's in the bargain bin now?
Like, yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, so because some of the things you hear about NX is this idea of like, well, you know, the remote computing kind of aspect
oh God,
that you might have. Yeah, that you might have modular kind of things that'd help it perform at a higher level. And then, you know, that raises the prospect of, you know, well, does the game have to kind of be made to scale somewhat depending on,
Or you just
device.
Have the sticker that says you have to have this. You just have to have this add-on box.
I mean, the NX might have some of these sorts of issues that you're talking about.
Then you've
about.
Made if, the Genesis.
If it plays out along those sorts of lines, it could have some of these issues that you're talking about with the PS4 upgrade. But I guess the difference would be, if you're starting the platform out with that explicitly in mind, maybe you could just make it more transparent for the developers and easy and hopefully not too confusing for consumers, because we've just come off a generation where 3DS was too confusing as a name, Wii U was too confusing as a name, we when you get names are too confusing, I mean this sort of stuff must be positively perplexing to the average punter. So
I think the obvious solution is to make every game made for the portable version, and the games that require the base home console included in the box, just like the memory pack.
Yeah,
like the N64.
They just include the home console in the box.
Every game that needs it.
Just have a closet just full of them.
Just like DK64, which was expansion pack compatible because otherwise it made the N64 die, and that was the only reason.
I look forward to Guillaume's terrible future where we have Glitter Metroid and 37 NX console units based in our closet because it's come with every game.
It's gonna happen. But yeah, I think that the trouble we've had like relating this back to Nintendo shows just how much Sony probably didn't think of them when they made
I'm sure they thought of them because, I mean, here's the thing. Everybody is making a move right now. Like, Microsoft, we keep hearing, like, these weird conflicting messaging out of Microsoft on this. We hear Microsoft has experimented with lots of different things that could be an Xbox One successor or an Xbox One version. We hear their core management saying, like, no, I don't like the idea of these iterative consoles.
Yep.
We hear them starting to tilt towards, like, well, you can have the Xbox experience on your PC. Like they're a company that of the
and the
three
latest thing with that
pulled.
Is that they filed they had a filing with the FCC that's under NDA that expires directly after E3, so they're gonna announce they're gonna announce a new Xbox console something,
right?
It's gonna be announced at E3, so something's happening.
They are of the three, they're the company feeling like they're being pulled in the most directions, and of course you think about what they are as a company, that makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of stakeholders in Microsoft who are probably going to their executive board going like, no, Xbox needs to bend to our fucking will because we have this thing that we can leverage to sell with it.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is I think they also have the most to gain from this just because they're the ones that Xbox One was always perceived as like the underpowered console. Right.
Oh, absolutely they do. But they've got like lots of things like, well, they want to serve their PC market, so they're doing that. So does it make sense for them to push out like four versions of the Xbox maybe? Like, why are they still testing a bunch of versions? Like, all that shit's weird.
Well, but I mean, it's not like they're going to bundle in like Azure. I mean, they already have OneDrive integrated in there.
No,
so,
God, no. That would be funny.
But I mean, I don't know what else you mean by like what else they're going to sell with it or whatever.
Well, no, like so the fact that we're hearing reports that they're still testing different things.
Yeah.
It's like, What? How much is there to test? Like, is it? This isn't just a boosted device.
Yeah, but like, I mean, it is a PC now. That thing's running Windows 10. So.
Oh yeah. Oh, totally. Like if they just didn't up the hardware specs, like what are you still testing? Like what are you? E3's in like a month and a half.
Yeah. See, I wonder what the impact of like stuff like Steam boxes has been. You know, because like Steam boxes, right? Now they aren't really popular.
All right, Guillaume, well played. But at the same time, you could say Apple TV.
What I'm saying though is, in terms of the
PC
market, are they afraid of the PC market coming in and kind of like making a bunch of cheap pseudo consoles and tossing them out there,
more
and actually competing with the PS4 and Xbox?
More that than probably the Steam box, like more just the generalized. Like Asus has now put out their home. They're like, attached to your TV and you're good to go console PC. It probably does worry them a bit.
Yeah, I mean, they're more like PCs now, so that's good on one hand, but on the other hand, it kind of exposes them to competitors that they maybe wouldn't have had before.
Well, and it goes back to the conversation we had in the previous email, where if your game can run on that hardware, you put it there, which is why we're seeing a lot of, albeit bad, PC ports showing up now for games that would have never had PC ports two generations ago.
Yep, like Dark Souls 3, for example.
Yeah, these are PCs, and ultimately, making a port from one to the other, especially for the Xbox One version, is trivial. So you do it, and you do a bad job of it because you don't have experience on it, but like, eventually, these companies are going to not fuck up all their PC ports, and
yeah,
does that become a viable competitor? Well, if people bring PCs into their living room, then yes, it does. If the PC stays segregated out in the office, then maybe you buy time, but eventually those devices get smaller and more portable, and that becomes an issue. I think the one challenger we've seen sort of pushed out of the mindshare is the set-top box as a competitor. Because no set-top box as a video game console has caught on yet. And I think ultimately, because those things serve so many masters, they're just not good at producing video games. And that becomes difficult. Because if it's got to be also your music player and your primary streaming device and something that your grandmother can use, like, there's so much stuff going on in there that it becomes like a video game also ran. I don't want to say it gets next gauged or engaged, but there is kind of this weird, like, it's not good at games, it's proficient at them. It's to John's voice, a well-crafted piece of hardware clearly made by professionals that's ultimately trying to do too much. So I think now PC has to, like, there was a period like 2 years ago where set-top boxes were deep, frightening things for the console manufacturers. I think now it's the consoleized PC, since they've PC-ized the console. That, you know, but for Microsoft's case, fuck it, we get a license for Windows anyway, we don't care. And I think that shows up in their new strategy, like, fine, pay us $500 per Windows license, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, that costs us way less to make than an Xbox.
Yep.
We'll take that money, and we'll run with it. That's also why having the Windows Live, not Game for Windows Live, geez, I don't call it that anymore, for having, what do they call it? They just call it Xbox Live, don't they?
Yeah, dude, it's just all Xbox Live. I mean, basically, they just patched Windows into Xbox Live.
Having Xbox, well, the other way around, though. I mean, having Xbox Live on PCs is important because they still want to get that cut. Yep. That if you're buying games through Steam, they don't get.
It's a
weird place for each of these manufacturers right now, because they're all trying to do something that's different from where we've been traditionally. And like, maybe it's being driven by larger interests inside their company to some degree. Maybe it's being driven by market factors, but each of them has somewhat of a different motivation in play right now. And that makes it really hard to say, well, this is being driven by market factors, when each of these companies is in such a different place. So I don't think any one's being pushed by the other, but I do think maybe Sony and Microsoft, looking at Nintendo coming out now, could say, well, this is as good an opportunity as any, versus trying to do another hardware launch like next year. And it's going to feel for the consumers like, God, is it going to be hardware launches every year?
Yeah.
Because I think that's the point where you might see console burnout, if every year is a console launch.
Yeah.
Like, it loses any mystique.
Yep. And I mean, the thing is, I mean, Sony really hasn't done a good job with actually having exclusive titles for PS4 either. So
no,
it's like, if you decided to go with the PC versus a PS4, what are you really missing out on? Like, I mean, in terms of top tier games,
Uncharted,
yeah, Bloodborne, maybe, yeah.
Bloodborne, yeah, but you've got Dark Souls. So like, yeah, I know it's not the same game,
exactly,
but you still got Dark Souls.
Exactly.
Like, you still got From Software there.
Yep,
they're still hanging out.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, this goes back to the truly confusing commercial that Microsoft had for the Xbox One, home of all of the best of the top 10 selling softwares. That's a, the fuck does that phrase even mean?
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's such a weird market right now that I think ultimately all three players are trying to find a place in it that makes sense for them, and doing these launches now lets them do it, regardless of what the other ones are doing.
Yeah.
Right. And Nintendo is more pushed by the failure of the Wii U and right. kind of the slowing down of the 3DS than anything else that the other guys are doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and, sure. and also that ties in more to Japan than what the, you know, I mean, obviously Microsoft is practically non-existent in Japan.
What is Japan?
I mean,
they're not even like there anymore.
And even Sony is not exactly setting the world on fire. So,
exactly.
It's Nintendo that's had, you know, the 3DS that's had, and that sold over 20 million units in Japan alone. Yeah, that has actual third party partners that have had success on 3DS in that country. You know, so they've got a very different sort of set of motivating factors, and that's just why, you know, to be honest, I've kind of struggled to see the NX having this whole selling point of it being more powerful than PS4 and Xbox One, because that's not what sells units in Japan, not for a long time now. That it's the biggest, baddest thing on the market. You know, that has not been the primary motivator of the Japanese video game consumer for goodness knows how long.
The only thing I could think of is if they want to keep... if you think of who Nintendo's most important partners are right now, it's Bandai Namco, Square Enix, and...
Atlas.
And if you want to keep those three happy, you need to make it easy for them to put their PS4 games on your system. Because those those three ultimately don't want to have one console manufacturer dominate their home region, because that means their negotiating power sucks. Mm-hmm. So if you can do something where, like, hey, look, you don't want to play ball? We'll put this on Nintendo. What? You want? Try us. Like, we basically gave them Shin Megami Tensei. We'll do it.
Yeah.
And, like, that gives them some leverage. And if Nintendo wants to be a good partner for them, ultimately, I think they needed to at least make it possible to give those partners leverage and make themselves a viable target for their games.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that, but that's more in the region of sort of parity rather than anything beyond that. And maybe even if we're talking about a family of systems up to parity, where, you know, with perhaps entry-level devices beneath that. That's what I've been envisioning, but I'm not the most well read on all the rumors and which ones are more sort of substantiated than others.
Don't worry about any of them.
That is generally my attitude. Yeah, but I just don't feel like that's it. Really, the mood in the camp, as it were, at the moment. It feels like expectations are being built up higher than that to me. I don't know everybody else's senses.
Just remember, the rumor engine's always driven by the Defense Force. And they're going to be the ones who are going to be like, you know, I've seen this patent that Nintendo got about these computing devices. The NX doesn't exist. It's hundreds of devices you plug into your Wii U for power. Like, that's where you're going to get the people who are off the deep end. Our audience. Hey, guys. Hi. We love you guys. That's going to do it for this week. I'm sorry I called you guys off the deep end. I really am. If you think NX is a bunch of daisy chain devices attached to your Wii U, you're probably insane. But, I can break news for you now. That's not what it is. But if you want to send us your theory on what the NX is, I mean, we might make fun of it. If you want to send us your insane theory, I probably won't read it on the show, but I might have a good laugh. Or if you just want to send us some questions, you can email us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And while you're poking around, be sure to vote for our poll on for our next retroactive game. This time, we have decided, because I really like Castlevania music primarily, to do a Castlevania retroactive. Your choices are Super Castlevania 4 for the Super Nintendo, Castlevania Rondo of Blood for the TG-16, is the CD, I guess.
Turbo Duo.
Turbo Duo.
But Wii Virtual Console.
On the Wii Virtual Console. Castlevania Aria of Sorrow for the Game Boy Advance, which is also on the Virtual Console. Castlevania Order of Ecclesia for the DS. And Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth for the Wii Shop. WiiWare. Yes. Sorry. It's been a while since I've had to write download articles. The voting will run through roughly... I think I said the end of the month. So yeah. I'm going to hold that for now. Voting is tight right now, so feel free to go vote and tell us what era of Castlevania you want to see. We will be doing the retroactive for that, I would guess, middle to end of next month in the lead up to E3. Also, I'm going to go ahead and do a little self-promotion here. I did a radio trivia. It's up right now. In fact, it went up the same day as last week's episode. It is primarily focused, entirely focused, actually, around official albums of video games that are remixes. Situations where the publisher of the game licensed or, in fact, in some cases, produced an album that, in almost all of those cases, were sold in Japanese record stores that featured music not from the game, but was remixes of music from the game for which the album was made. Some of that stuff is pretty cool. Couple of them are kind of weird. Rooted Trivia, if you don't listen to it, is a really cool podcast. You should give it a listen. We play music from a game, and you guess what the game is. It's a fun opportunity to hear some good music and hear some conversation about some interesting games. Remember, emails, vote, Radio Trivia. Also, if you want to send us your suggestion for what music we should end the show with, like we're about to do right here, you could send that to the inbox, or you could post it in the talkback. This week, our suggestion comes from Terramore via the NeoGAF thread. The song is Day in the Forest, and it's from the Super Nintendo game Draken, which is a game that none of us knew about. But the song's good. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Time again.
That time?
Games are out. Games, plural. Plural games are out.
Where are you going with this?
Talk about here. And for that reason.
Oh, so am I still on the call?
It's time for new business. And I'm going to lead off this week because I actually.